And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this is the Earth First Update for April 16th. Let's start off by asking that you get your pencil and paper ready, because there are things to write down: web pages, addresses, phone numbers, dates, times, places, URLs, web streams, all that kind of stuff. You might want to know what's happening. When you want to do something about it, that's when you need the pencil and paper. Let's start off with announcements. The Earth Day Restoration in Alameda Creek is going to be happening on Saturday, April 25th. Join fellow Alameda Creek Alliance members as we continue stewardship of our adopted stretch of Alameda Creek in Niles Canyon on Saturday, April 25th from 10 a.m. to noon. We'll continue our focus on Cape and English ivy removal at the site and discuss how these efforts protect and enhance fish and wildlife habitat. Come and enjoy a couple of hours working along with us on a beautiful reach of the Alameda Creek. We'll meet at 10 a.m. at the Niles Staging Area parking lot along Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in the Niles area of Fremont. The address is roughly 720 Old Canyon Road. We'll take a short walk upstream where we'll perform habitat enhancements works until about noon. We'll provide gloves, waste bags, tools, water, and a snack. Please wear work clothes, and that would include long pants and sturdy closed-toe shoes that can get dirty. The work isn't on much of a slope, but the ground can be uneven and the work can be dusty. There is poison oak nearby, but not in the immediate area where we'll be working. However, a long sleeve shirt and hat are recommended. It may be warm. Please bring your own reusable water bottle to fill. For more information, go to www.alamedacreek.org. And once again, their Earth Day restoration is Saturday, April 25th in Niles Canyon at 10 a.m. Want to let you know about something happening down in South America. This is the persecution of Carlos Perez Cuartambel, and we get the story from Intercontinental Cry. Today, Carlos Perez Cuartambel had to appear in Ecuadorian court to defend himself against allegations of a coup attempted against President Rafael Correa on September 30th. 2010. The accusation was made by Irina Cabezas, a legislator in Correa's party, Alianza País. Perez Cuartambel is a lawyer, having worked in defense of water rights, who has been attacked for his anti-mining activism and jailed three times for it under the current administration. In 2013, he was accused of, quote, terrorism, sabotage, and sedition. His sentence subsequently reduced by a court that considered his struggle in defense of water to be altruistic. He has been named one of the frontline defenders of human rights, an organization with special consultative status in relationship to the United Nations, ECOSOC. Perez Cuartambel has authored many books relating to indigenous justice and water rights. Today, he is also president of Ecuadorianari, a federation of Quichua people of Ecuador. This is the oldest indigenous organization of its kind and has considerable power to motivate activists representing about 70% of Ecuador's indigenous people. Ecuadorianari has been systematically persecuted for its defense of water, as well as its civil disobedience in refusing to comply with Decree 16, which prohibits free association and imposes total state control. The resistance of the organization to the country's water law, passed in 2014, which ratifies the expropriation and privatization of water, and all of that happening in advance of mining operations into water sources, and the new land law of this year, which has ratified the reconcentration of land for the purpose of agrofuel production. The situation in Ecuador is one of state terrorism. The criminalization of political dissent and social protest is only intensified with censorship and persecution of everyone from community leaders to cartoonists. The climate has only worsened since the protests of March 19th, when approximately 70,000 people took to the streets of Quito to protest government policies, with thousands more protesting in other cities. In the days that followed, many journalists were harassed and or had their equipment stolen. Perez Gartambel, who has been under systematic surveillance from the government intelligence services, was charged by Cabezas days after the protests as part of a broad wave of persecution meant to intimidate the opposition. Given this trying state of affairs for the indigenous movement and for Perez Gartambel in particular, the international community is being urged to divulge this persecution as widely as possible. If you want more information about Carlos Perez Gartambel or Intercontinental Cry, go to www.intercontinentalcry.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. After last week's intense frenzy of hazing, buffalo were back on the move, returning to areas they had been forced out of. This made the busy weekend for patrols along the highway, but thanks to our hot pink road signs, no buffalo were struck by vehicles this week. Most of the buffalo migrated back to suitable habitat along the South Fork of the Madison River south of Horse Butte, where the Montana Department of Livestock has zero tolerance for them. By Monday morning, much to the chagrin of the Montana Department of Livestock, more than 130 buffalo were gracing this beautiful grass-filled landscape. Another senseless hazing operation was imminent. Montana Department of Livestock, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks agents once again descended upon the South Fork to abuse wild buffalo and displace migratory birds such as sandhill cranes and white pelicans. After hours of chasing two large groups of buffalo around in circles, the operation moved from the South Fork just east down the Madison Arm Road of the Gallatin National Forest. The bellowing of the Montana Department of Livestock and Fish, Wildlife, and Park agencies yelling yah and hey, 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 and even hee-haw, shouted over and over again, echoed through the forest and in all of our heads. All species, bald and golden eagles, wolves, moose, grizzly bears, elk, and more, suffer this mad cowboy disease, and there's not a single cow on the landscape. The agents have been repeatedly hazing wild buffalo out of so-called tolerance areas, where the buffalo, so many of them just hours away from giving birth, are allowed to be. For multiple days each week, buffalo are repeatedly pushed for miles over dusty roads and fallen trees without time to graze or even drink water. As has been the Montana Department of Livestock and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks tactic this spring, the hazing doesn't end until the buffalo cross north over the Madison River. Sometimes it doesn't end there, as agents will follow the buffalo across the river, pushing them towards Horse Butte. These agents assume that the buffalo are going to behave like livestock and stay where they're told. But buffalo don't adhere to man-made laws or stay on one side or another of imaginary lines. They follow the power of their ancient instincts. As soon as the agents are gone, the buffalo resume the displaced journey back to their chosen ground on the South Fork of the Madison. Once these Madison Arm Road hazes reach the water's edge, buffalo immediately dip their heads for a much-needed drink. The edge of the lake is thick with spring mud, and the buffalo hooves sink in deep, but as thirsty as they are, even wet earth offers a bit of relief to a parched throat. Bellowing with laughter and cracking jokes, the agents wait at the water's edge for the buffalo to cross. If the buffalo don't move fast enough, the bullies break out their shotguns to fire explosive rounds that scare them across the river. As the buffalo are forced to move off of their ancestral lands, as these men laugh it up, congratulating themselves on a job well done, our heads fill with anger, our hearts break, and our resolve strengthens. After Monday's haze, on our way back to our cars, we passed through a group of about 100 buffalo heading west towards the South Fork. We knew that on Tuesday they would likely be hazed back. One young female had birthing material hanging from her, but no calf. Where was that calf? From a radio-collared female we saw, we knew this group had been hazed very recently, and that this forced removal likely caused her to miscarry. On Tuesday, the same group was found along the South Fork and were hazed down the same path again. Wednesday morning, checking for South Fork for buffalo, patrols found one lone and very pregnant female who was likely separated from her family during a previous haze. She was nervous and distraught about being away from the herd, although alone she is extremely vulnerable to hungry wolves and grizzly bears. Tuesday afternoon, we learned that while we were following and documenting Monday's haze, a lone bull buffalo had been shot on Pat Pova's ranch, where there are currently no cattle. Inquiring with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, we learned that Pofar had been complaining, so Fish, Wildlife, and Parks contacted a state hunter who did not fill his buffalo tag and had him come and shoot the bull. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks says they are going to try using this new tactic to teach buffalo not to go on Pova's property. It's possible they will allow a bull a week to be shot in this manner. A bull a week. It just gets weirder and weirder up there. And it's been snowing a lot, too. Anyway, you can contact the Buffalo Field Campaign at their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign. They have lots of information about how to volunteer. They will need volunteers this summer. And they have lots more information about things they need. And once you figure out what you can send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call, area code 406-646-0070. And if you need to know more information than that, go to www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And to remember that, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And six Greenpeace activists have left the Arctic-bound oil rig. This story by Alex Dubozinski's and Chris Skinner in San Francisco, editing by Margarita Choi and Robert Bursell, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Six Greenpeace activists rappelled down from an oil rig in the Pacific Ocean on Saturday after spending 6 days living on the structure to protest against drilling in the Arctic. The multinational team climbed aboard Polar Pioneer, an oil rig leased by Royal Dutch Shell PLC that is bound for the Arctic, on Monday as it was being transported by a heavy lift vessel about 750 miles northwest of Hawaii. Worsening weather conditions that were expected to bring high swell led the six activists to leave the oil rig on Saturday, a Greenpeace representative said in an email. They climbed down into inflatable boats and returned to the Greenpeace ship Esperanza, which had been stationed in the area in recent days and had brought the activists out into the Pacific Ocean for the protest. Shell said the protesters had jeopardized their safety and that of the crew assigned to the oil rig. The company had filed a complaint in federal court in Alaska seeking an order to remove the activists. On Saturday evening, a judge granted a restraining order against Greenpeace to prevent a repeat of the protest, Royal Dutch Shell spokeswoman Kelly Opdewey said in an email. We're always open to an honest discussion about the challenges and benefits of exploring for energy in the Arctic, but we cannot condone Greenpeace's awful and unsafe tactics. She said, unlawful, that was. Greenpeace said its team of activists did not interfere with the crew transporting the oil rig. The organization had earlier said on its website that the activists had enough supplies to last for several days on the rig. I might be climbing off this oil rig, but this is merely a transition into the next step of saving the Arctic, said American Aaliyah Field, one of the six activists. And groups have sued to the United States to halt killing of grizzlies near Yellowstone National Park in this story by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Daniel Wallace and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Wildlife advocates are suing the Obama administration to prevent the killing of protected grizzly bears that come into conflict with sportsmen over elk they kill or wound during annual hunts in northwest Wyoming. The Sierra Club and Western Watersheds Project accuses the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service of violating the Endangered Species Act with a permit allowing four grizzlies to be killed over 7 years during elk hunts in Grand Teton National Park, south of Yellowstone National Park. The wildlife advocates argue that those anticipated grizzly deaths, combined with federal permits sanctioning the deaths of grizzlies elsewhere in the region, may mean that as many as 65 female bears could be killed annually. That would amount to 3 times the mortality limit set by U.S. wildlife managers, the activists say in their lawsuit filed last Friday in U.S. court in Washington, D.C. The outsized humpback-shouldered grizzly bears, considered an icon of the American West, were added to the federal endangered and threatened species list in the lower 48 states in 1975 after hunting, trapping, and poisoning cut their numbers to just 1,000 from an estimated 100,000 a century ago. Most grizzlies that still roam the lower 48 are in and around Yellowstone National Park, which encompasses parts of Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. In most cases, it is illegal to kill grizzlies and other federally protected animals without special permits from the Fish and Wildlife Service. In 2013, the agency issued such a permit for Grand Teton, where the search for food by bears can bring them into conflict with hunters over elk carcasses, and where hunters shot and killed a grizzly in 2012. The fact that the government responded to that killing by authorizing the killing of 4 more bears in one of our nation's premier parks ought to be telling us something is wrong with our management of grizzlies and parks, said Tom Presso, attorney for Earth Justice, the environmental law firm representing the conservation groups. A spokesperson for the Fish and Wildlife Service said the agency does not comment on pending or ongoing litigation. An interagency government panel overseeing Yellowstone area grizzlies has said that the population of roughly 600 bears has recovered and recommended that they be stripped of federal protections, which could ultimately open the way for hunting. And the Forest Service has moved to permit coal mining in a Colorado roadless forest in this story by Ted Zukowski of Earth Justice, as found in the Earth First Newswire. National and local conservation groups have called on the U.S. Forest Service to rescind its brazen move to revive a gaping loophole in the Colorado roadless rule. The loophole paves the way for Arch Coal, the nation's second largest coal company, to build roads and scrape well pads over thousands of acres of otherwise protected publicly owned national forest and critical wildlife habitat in the state. The loophole was thrown out by U.S. District Court of Colorado last year after the Forest Service failed to consider the climate change impacts of providing Arch Coal and one other company with access to up to 350 million tons of federal coal. Reopening the loophole could result in more than 500 million tons of carbon pollution from mining and burning that coal. The mines that would be covered by the loophole, all located in the North Fork Valley near Paonia, Colorado, daily emit millions of cubic feet of methane, a gas more than 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a heat-trapping gas. The coal mine loophole is a lose-lose-lose proposition. It's bad for wildlife, bad for hikers and hunters who enjoy Colorado's wild forests, and it's bad for our climate, said Earth Justice Attorney Ted Zukowski, who represented the groups in federal court. Last year's court decision plugged the loophole and will work to keep it plugged. It's bad enough the Forest Service is considering sacrificing our public lands for dirty coal mining. Now they're doing so at the demand of Arch Coal, a company some analysts say is on the verge of bankruptcy, said Climate and Energy Program Director Jeremy Nichols of Wild Earth Guardians. The Forest Service's proposal is not only directly at odds with the urgent need to reduce greenhouse gases, but it's at odds with preserving Colorado's natural legacy of vibrant wild forests. The Forest Service's proposal undermines the good work the Obama administration is doing to protect our climate through the Clean Power Plan, fuel efficiency standards, and targets for reducing the nation's carbon emissions, said Sierra Club organizer Bryce Carter. This proposal puts the Forest Service dangerously out of step with the rest of the administration and makes a sacrifice of our public lands. The plan shows a dangerous disconnect between Obama's climate rhetoric and his plans to open more public land to the fossil fuel industry, said Taylor McKinnon of the Center for Biological Diversity. The world's quickly dwindling carbon budget has no room for new coal mines. This coal can't be burned if we're going to keep our planet livable. The president should withdraw this proposal now. Amanda Jossen, the Wildlife Energy Conservation Fellow with the Natural Resources Defense Council, said, "The Forest Service should do what's good for the people of Colorado, not what's good for a profit-making company whose product would further pollute the air, despoil our land, and worsen carbon pollution that fuels climate change. The service needs to drop this proposal," said Amanda Jossen, a Wildlife Energy Conservation Fellow with the Natural Resources Defense Council. In 2012, the Forest Service adopted the Colorado Roadless Rule, which generally banned road construction on 4 million acres of the state's most wild remote forest lands. The rule, however, contained a number of loopholes, including one permitting road construction on 19,000 acres of roadless forest north and east of Paonia in Colorado to benefit future coal mining proposals there. In 2013, the Forest Service approved Arch Coal's proposal to build 6 miles of road and scrape 48 pads for methane drainage wells in the Sunset Roadless Area, a project made possible by the coal mining loophole. Conservation groups sued to halt the project, in part on grounds that the Forest Service failed to disclose the extent of carbon pollution generated by mining and burning of 350 million tons of coal made possible by the Colorado Roadless Rule. In June of 2014, a federal court sided with the groups, ruled that the Forest Service broke the law by sweeping climate pollution impacts under the rug and subsequently threw out the coal mine loophole. The Forest Service's announcement gives the public until May 22nd to comment on that proposal. And the spotted owl could be designated endangered in this story by Courtney Sherwood, with editing by Eric M. Johnson and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The U.S. government said recently that it is launching a review on whether to list northern spotted owls as endangered species after a decades-old fight between conservationists and loggers. The Fish and Wildlife Service said new scientific findings by a conservation group petitioning for greater protections for the medium-sized owl warranted a review of its designation as threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. The spotted owl was listed as threatened species in 1990 amid high-profile battles between the timber industry, which fought to retain the right to log centuries-old evergreen trees, and conservationists who argued that both the bird and the ecosystem it relied on were on the brink of destruction. The population of spotted owls, which are dark brown with white spots on the head and breast and dark brown eyes, has continued to decline at a rate of about 2.9% per year to an estimated population of fewer than 10,000, the Fish and Wildlife Service estimates. Conservationists put the number at fewer than 4,000. The decline comes despite logging restrictions and a plan launched by wildlife officials in 2011 to thin the population of barred owls, a rival from farther east that has encroached on the native cousin's habitat in the old-growth forests of the Pacific Northwest. Fish and wildlife officials said the loss of old-growth forests was deemed the most significant threat to the owls in the 1990s, but the growing population of the larger, more aggressive barred owls is now seen as a greater threat as they disrupt spotted owls' nesting and compete for food. Spotted owl numbers have continued to fall despite protections, and both threats would be analyzed in the federal review. On a positive note, the experimental removal of barred owls is showing real promise, with early reports indicating that spotted owl populations rebound when barred owl populations are reduced, said Paul Henson, Oregon supervisor for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Our review of the spotted owl will tell us whether current efforts to address the threats are sufficient. Being listed as endangered would largely be a symbolic change in terms of protection afforded the species, the Fish and Wildlife Service said. Notice announcing the review of the spotted owl's designation, which will take many months, was scheduled to run in the Federal Register on April 10th. And Japan hopes to resume their whale hunt this year despite opposition, in this story by Elaine Lies and Sarah Young, editing by Clarence Fernandez, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Japan said on Monday that it hoped to resume its Antarctic whale hunt around the end of this year after providing further information to win over an international panel that says its whaling plan does not prove the need for killing the animals. Last year, the International Court of Justice ruled that Japan's decades-old whale hunt in the Southern Ocean should stop, prompting Tokyo to cancel the bulk of its whaling for the 2014-2015 season this past winter, and submit a scaled-down plan for future hunts. Japan has long maintained that most whale species are not endangered and that eating whale is part of its food culture. On Monday, an expert panel of the International Whaling Commission, the global body that oversees whales, said it opposed the new Japanese whaling plan that proposed to take 333 minke whales in the Antarctic. Japan's commissioner to the IWC, Joji Murashita, said the country would furnish additional material before a May meeting of the IWC's scientific panel for a final report, adding that Tokyo hoped the new data would win over the panel. I believe that we'll move forward with the aim of resuming whaling around the end of the year, Morishita told a news conference, though he did not rule out the possibility of changes to the proposal. The IWC's expert panel said the information in Japan's latest proposal did not enable it to determine if lethal sampling of whales was necessary. The current proposal does not demonstrate the need for lethal sampling to achieve those objectives, it said, referring to the plan's key aims. Japan's determination to resume whaling remains unchanged, said Morishita, echoing statements by government leaders. Japan took the panel's recommendations seriously, he said, but added, they haven't unilaterally said that it's not good. Neither have they come out on the other side with, go ahead, do whatever research you want to do. Japan began what it calls scientific whaling in 1987, a year after an international whaling moratorium took effect despite growing global opposition. It also runs a separate whaling program in the Northern Pacific that was unaffected by the international court ruling. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show on Free Radio tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. And if you are in Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to Radio Free Moscow, 90.3 KRFP Radio. And that's their new high-power frequency. Hopefully they've got their high-power transmitter going. And they present the Earth First Update at 9:30 p.m. on Mondays. And you can go to Radio Free Edmonton's new website, northbysouthradio.com. That's northbysouthradio.com. And they present the Earth First Update at sometime whenever they're on the air. You can also go to the website, radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous podcasts of the Earth First Update at radioforall.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for, well, no, actually next week I'm not going to be here. I am going to be out fishing. So tune in 2 weeks for another update from the Earth First Update.